Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. On this episode of the show, I'm joined by author Norman McCombs, whose debut novel, A Reason to Be, is out on September 1st. Now, Norman has an array of achievements to his name, and I'm not going to do them justice if I just try and rattle them off the top of my head. So to avoid that, I'm going to read them from my piece of paper here and make sure I do them justice. First and foremost, Norman is a fellow of the American Society of Mechanical Engineering, which honored him with the Edison Medal, which is their highest patent award available. He has over 200 patents registered worldwide, and get this, in 2013, he was awarded the National Medal of Technology and Innovation from President Obama for developing the portable oxygen concentrator, which has changed countless lives. His novel, A Reason to Be, is a tale of loss, hope, and the transcendent power of love that binds us to one another, and it's inherently inspired by many of his own personal stories and journeys from his life. So I hope you all enjoy the show. Let's dive right into it. And if it resonates with you, please share, comment, and help spread the word.
They took your proprietary technology and your patent, and then they just used it to bring this wholesale to market, or?
No, I did. I was the manufacturing wing. I manufactured the products in Exodus. They didn't know anything about the application, frankly. So I remained on as president for quite some time.
Gotcha.
And then gradually phased out as a consultant.
But because, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't these portable concentrators reasonably new to the market? Or has it actually been never been around for a while?
No, no. I introduced the first one in 1976. They've been around a long time.
Okay.
There was resistance to it because there was a lot of investment made in containerized oxygen by the distributors. So suddenly we eliminated the Iceman, if you don't know what I mean. You're not old enough to know. Sure. When I was a kid, they actually delivered ice to the door. You know?
Right.
Then a refrigerator came along. So that's sort of what happened with us. But the people that had invested in the ice, you know, they didn't want anything to do with us. So the distribution system, the marketing aspect of it was a little difficult. But we got into it, and now we're the dominant source. I sold out, but the system I made was the original one. And,
but it's changed. I mean, it does change lives. It lets people still be mobile and do things and not worry about being tethered to, you know, oxygen in the hospital or at home. And that liberty and freedom is everything.
I didn't realize the impact it was going to have because my application was for wastewater treatment.
Okay.
And it was when they found out about the need for particularly COPD patients. People at a local subsidiary of W.A. Grace came to me and said, "Why aren't you making this for human use?" And I said, I don't know anything about that. And the insurance is, I don't want to take responsibility for supporting life. Sure. But I had gone into veterinary applications and they saw that. And so they said, "Well, can you make one for us?" And I said, "Yeah." And a fellow Scott, a guy named Don McCune, came to me and said, "We need a system like 5 liters per minute." And I said, "Okay, that's pretty small compared to what I'm used to doing, but it was in the ballpark for veterinarian applications." And so we, on a handshake, in 6 months, introduced the first oxygen concentrator at the Fontainebleau in Miami. And then it took, as you said, though, you know, you think it's relatively new, right?
I don't know if I just made that up. I thought I had like 2020, sort of 10 to 2012 in mind. But
no, we introduced them actually. That'd be 44 years ago.
I think it might be certain models, certain makes, or certain models that have maybe higher flow now, or go up.
No, it all stemmed from the unit that we call the New Life that was 5 liters per minute.
Okay.
And we made millions of those, and they're still out there. And I gradually got it down to a kilogram, which is but that wouldn't be suitable for someone like your father.
No, we had
basically. 2 liters per minute, and a pulse dose delivers oxygen and inhalation only. Your father probably needed to flood the whole zone.
We did initially when he flew out to the States. We had the small portable, which went up to, I think, yeah, 2 or 3 liters a minute continuous, and then it's just pulse flow. That was enough then, but when he flew with his condition, it made it so much worse that to come back, as I say, we couldn't fly. So we needed the 10 liter per minute big, big boy that had to be wheeled around and always mainlined. But, you know, without either of those, we would have been stranded in California. So,
I wish I could say that I had intended that to happen, but I didn't know anything about that market until they came. So then I'll build it. And then once I got into it, I learned a lot, and I got involved with the really good thing from my point of view was I was able to meet a lot of very nice people and families, and found out what the need was and what the, you know, what the issues were associated with the concentrator, because they initially we didn't have an oxygen monitor that could actually, that was reliable as a machine that you could actually measure the concentration of oxygen.
Yeah.
So we went through a lot of, but we ultimately, my wife contracted Alzheimer's, and took care of her for a lot of years. I phased out of that part of my life.
How was that period in terms of juggling those two things? Was it a phase out, or was it a clear cut off to just go, no, I'm
focused? There were too many people dependent upon me to just stop. So all of me, myself and my partners, we did it the gradual way possible. I wasn't admitting it, Ashley. And I felt I'm an engineer, I'm a scientist, I can fix her. And I got to the point where I just couldn't get out of bed anymore, but I wasn't admitting. I had to get help, and that was the worst day of my entire life, you know, when I had to
face up to that.
I had to face up to it. Yeah, you know, it's an unholy disease. I think all diseases are unholy. I mean, you're going through something horrible with your father. You know, this thing. You see someone. We were high school sweethearts, married 56 years, together 5 years before that. And to see somebody just fade away in front of you and you're helpless. But I'd have these moments where I'd read these things, oh my goodness, there's some breakthrough. Mm. It was all smoke and mirrors. People trying to make money on it.
Yeah. Being there, got the t-shirt. I think that's the inherent nature of us as humans though, right? Eternal hope. It's a big part of it.
I think you have to live on hope. I always thought of myself as strong intellectually, but emotionally, I've always had a really tough time with death and sickness. One of my hobbies was raising and training English bulldogs.
Okay.
It's because my wife really loved English bulldogs, so I got into that in a big way. But just losing a dog, I couldn't even do that anymore. Really, you don't outlive them. So, anyway, so I went through a period of time where I was questioning my own ability to survive it. I didn't want to admit it. I'd cover up. We just started staying home all the time. Could you continue to try and cover up? We shouldn't remember things or people or so forth, and that. After a while, that was untenable, so just stayed home and worked out of the home. And then finally, pretty much my only reason to be was to take care of Grace. The rest of it just fell away.
It is, I can't imagine what it must be like to go through that with someone who you've lived with for 50 plus years, childhood sweetheart, and the swell of emotions that goes with that.
Well, I don't know if sometimes I question whether we're really meant to do that. You know, I wasn't equipped to. Are we meant to live this long? You know, to deal with something like this is.
But adrenaline kicks in, you know.
You're expected age, you know, you're expected to live to be 100. I says no. You know, when I was a boy, you never know, sure. But when I was a boy, you know, living to be 60 was on the older side. I just turned 83 the other day, and sometimes I feel like 18, and sometimes I feel like I got a foot in the grave.
I know many 20-year-olds that would say the same thing, though, Norm. It's and it still doesn't prepare you for the experience that you had, or make it any easier to go through that process. And I think when you're in it and you're caring for someone, at least in my experience, the adrenaline kicks in. You almost just go on autopilot some days. I don't know if you resonate with that, but you kind of just find yourself doing things that you wouldn't. If you look back, you're like, how did I even do that and muster up the energy?
Yeah, you do. I think you do that about lots of things, whether it would be in sports or all challenges in business. You say, how the heck did I get? I look back at some of the reports I wrote or drawings I made. Where did I come up with that? You know, so my name's on it. I must have done it. You know, so
there's something deeper than what we know, I think, that brings out that.
Well, I'm not a deeply religious person, but I know I don't know it all, and so I have a. There's a little game I play sometimes with that people are into themselves to the point where they're the end all. You know, when the Earth used to be, they're still living as though they're the center of the universe, like we used to think the Earth was, right? I asked them to define infinity for me. Many mathematicians just throw infinity into the equation. Divide by it, you get zero. Multiply by it, you get what? Infinity squared. I mean, just keep going.
Sure.
So I get into that conversation, and usually it comes around to saying, "Well, you just have faith, right? You have faith in infinity. You know, you're using it all because you know when you deal with entropy in this universe of ours, we're constantly generating heat from our planet, and we should be heating up the universe, but we're not. And what you said is." Is it because it's an infinite heat sink? Okay. I mean, what does that mean? You know, is where does it end? You know, when you look, you don't want to think too deeply about that. You know, where does it end?
Because where does it begin is the equal side. Right? Sure.
Pardon me?
I was going to say, where does it begin is an equal part of that same question at the same end of the scale. So
well, I think, you know, there's a lot of biological series for that, you know, sure. But as far as the fact that the universe is expanding, when Sagan came out with his, I don't know what he called it, astronomy for dummies or whatever it was, at that time, the result of the Big Bang, we thought that it was like the frags from a hand grenade. And so this mass of material was imparted a certain amount of energy, and it was traveling through space. But kinetic energy equals 1/2 mv². And what happens is you have to use up that energy. And as a result of that, the velocity decreases. Okay? But that's not happening. I mean, particulate matter in our universe is accelerating. You know, where is it going? I don't know. I have no idea. I can't even, you know, theorize about that. So that's where religion comes into it. We don't things we don't understand. You have to. It is what it is. You have faith that there's something bigger than us that we don't understand. And I know too many people that think they know everything. And they rationalize it, but they always throw the word. They always use the word infinity in there. And you always catch them, and
you relish it.
I consider myself stupid, but I don't. I can't. I just cannot explain it. You know, except in this in a very myopic way. The point is, you know, you survive. God bless for you with your losing your dad. So you have a sense of what it was like for me.
Sure.
Especially being older, and we did not have children. I have a lot of loving nieces and nephews, and I'm really blessed with having what I really consider to be friends, which is hard to find a good friend. But when I went through all of this difficulty, the cream came to the surface.
Which it always does. You realize who's there more than just for the first few weeks, but who actually keeps coming back and coming back and really showing their true colors. And a lot of this, I mean, how did the book then come to be, Norm? Like, at what point do you go, I've been someone who's been an engineer and created all these amazing things and hundreds of patents, to go through that very tumultuous life experience and come out of that to then say, I'm going to write a book now? Was that part of your catharsis, or was it totally separate?
It's a complicated question, but when I was 9 to 10 years old, my father used to pick up junk, and he always saved the Saturday Evening Post and the Collier's magazines. You probably don't know what I'm talking about, but they would, in these magazines, they have a little section that said they invited people to write in short stories, mm-hmm. right? So my sister had this Royalite portable typewriter, and I decided that I was going to do that. So I hunt and pecked stories, short stories, and I got 1 cent stamp, made my own envelopes, and sent them in. My mother kept all of the rejections. Some of them were very polite and nice. They didn't know how old I was or any of that, but I did that for a couple of years. I was always interested in math and science, and that the people that knew me and counseled me said, you know, that's your strength, go in that direction. Mm-hmm. So I did. But in the back of my mind, I always felt, well, I like to write. Mm-hmm. I used to write short stories about my life, you know, fictional things, but about experiences I had with race, for instance. Because when I lived in the inner city of Buffalo, I went to an all-black school. So I was in the minority. I was only Caucasian in the school.
Right.
From kindergarten through third grade. We grew up together. I was jealous that they had this beautiful skin, you know. My father was equal opportunity hater. He hated Catholics more than he did black people. So
okay. Okay.
I went to the black school.
Right.
So I've always never understood racism. It gets me angry when I hear some of this on both sides now, because it's coming from all directions. Everybody jumping on the wagon. I've been, this is totally another story, but I've started a little, I think that the vast majority of human beings want to help other people. The vast, vast majority of people. Okay? It's just these fringes on each end that everybody hears because they're loud. I'm trying to come up with a way that we can recognize each other. Hmm. And what I've written is sort of an editorial.
Okay.
That no one knows it's me. No one knows it's an old white guy. Right? It could be coming from anyone. But just talks about humanity and kindness. And then I write out a series, it's not religious, but I can use the word commandments about how we should live our lives. And that we pledge to do that. And we agree to it. And if you agree to it, I'm designing a little yin and yang thing that I'm going to be sending out. I have an agent that's deeply into social media stuff, which I know nothing about. This is it. This is it, what we're doing right now me. But he's into that. And I just decided that we had to try and do something. Because when I hear these people talk on both sides of the aisle, one side more than the other, but.
Well, it's heavily agenda-based, you know.
Have to try and do something. You know, you can relate it, make an analogy with Christianity. In the old days, they wore a cross, and they would recognize each other as a being of a like mind, right? Mm-hmm. So if I come across another human being, the man of the race, if they see some symbol on me that says I'm doing my very best,
I'm with you.
Okay, so you recognize each other. You don't say anything, right? And because there's so many people out there that, you know, we just don't say anything. We sit back and we want to say, I don't even watch the news. I want to get into the conversation. You know, how can you say such a stupid thing?
Sure.
You know, but anyway, I'm going to do what I can in this regard.
That's all we can do. And I think, you know, a lot of it is divisiveness, where people have agendas to divide other people because they know that they can. And unfortunately, as you say, there's a small group of voices in different sides that are pushing that agenda, and then using things like social media, as you said earlier, to get that out there. And that's the thing, that there's access now that there wasn't before in terms of scale of reach. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't find themselves early enough, and they get very impressionable ideas thrown their way as well, which is an equal.
And it sticks. Danger.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So, but now that I have a gentleman named Scott Lorenz, who's my agent at this point, and really good guy, very much into social media. Now that I have Scott, maybe I can extend my feeling, you know, express my feelings in a way that's maybe meaningful. I've told a lot of people that what I'm doing, and they say, "Oh, never work." Others are encouraging, but. I'm doing it. I've also written another book, or in the process of my memoirs.
Okay.
As a result of this book, which is, what I tell everyone is 100% nonfiction emotionally. It's 100% fiction dialogue wise. Okay.
Right.
Because you have to make things up, right?
Sure.
And it's about 25%. Nonfiction, 25% fiction and 75% nonfiction as far as events are concerned.
Okay.
Because I've had people ask me, why not just call it a biography? Because I had to invent things. It's, you know, I'm too pragmatic to, I'm not going to say that I heard something if I didn't hear it, you know. So my only way around it was to change the names a bit and call it a novel.
Sure.
But emotionally, it's all me.
And I think that shines through, and I think that that's sort of why I was alluding to whether it was a cathartic process for you in some ways with the emotional side of what you had to explore, which I can imagine it must have been.
Oh yeah, I didn't really finish that thought. When Grace got sick, gradually my whole reason to be was to take care of her. That was it, right? I had talked to others throughout my life about wanting to write someday. If I was going to ever retire, I was going to be retiring and writing. And I really thought in terms of nonfiction, just to talk about what I know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know a lot about grief. Yeah.
Sure, sure.
I think I know a lot about love. And I know how to, I knew how to find them about my ancestry, which I found interesting.
Was so that always
over the
a
years,
passion?
Pardon me?
Sorry, was the ancestry part always a passion that you had?
No,
time,
an interesting part of that was that my father, who came from Canada in 1917, I was born in 1937. In the States, in Buffalo. He always used to be so proud of being Scottish, right? And Scots are always, I found that out. It's like a big club, you know, if you got that much Scottish.
Scots and Irish both have that kind of element to them.
Yeah, it's a... there's a certain arrogance about it. But my father didn't lack that. I was looking up my name, some patents I was looking for, and I saw a website that said descendants but of Timothy McCombs, and I had never heard of it. I had thought my father had his relatives, or he himself came directly from Scotland. The way he talked, never any details, right? But there's a gentleman named Murray McCombs in Toronto, which is only 100 miles away from Buffalo. He actually did a dissertation on the McCombs family, and I looked up, and there I was at the end of the line. Norman McCombs, you know, son of Robert, brother, sister, so forth. I tried to get a hold of him, and he had passed away. He's only 53 years old. But I read about it. They looked like some interesting ancestors back there, but that was in my mind. And again, I'm not a golfer or a fisherman. I do what I do. You know, I love science and engineering, and I'm a sculptor. I play the classical guitar. My mind drifts back to Grace periodically, so you have to forgive me.
It's okay. No.
She started showing signs of Alzheimer's, dementia. I continued with my business, but again, as the time went by, it got worse. To the point where I got so deeply absorbed in it that I came close to death myself. When I lost her, a particularly good friend of mine kept on insisting that I do what I always said I was going to do, get back into writing and genealogy, just distract yourself with that. He said, remember how you used to talk about doing that, you know,
which has some parallels. I'm not going to spoil it, but there's aspects of that in the novel as well. So there's
that's that right. Mark, that's the fellow named Mark. That's him.
Sure.
And he got me going, and when I had the thoughts about writing the book, I'm not blowing my own horn here. This, a point of fact is I was given the National Medal of Technology.
Yeah.
By Obama. And when I went to the White House, I've always been a person that looked ahead, but I found myself in a situation I couldn't look ahead. I didn't want to look back because of the sadness. I didn't look forward. So I was approaching the East Wing entrance of the White House. And I said, I'm going to make a mental note of where I am, how the heck I got here. You know, and usually I'm more interested in what's up there, you know, than where I am at the moment. So I just stood there. They let me alone. I just left alone to wander around the East Wing. And that's really when I said, I've got something to write about. This was a fellow that wrote for the Buffalo Evening News. He came down during an interview he was doing with me. He came up with a phrase or similar to it in the article that he wrote. It was distributed fairly widely. That I'd gone from this very humble house. I was born in a shack that my father built, and I wound up in the White House. And so I started saying, well, I'm going to talk about that. You know, I'm going to write about that. But I got, as I started writing it and formulating the plan for it, how do I segment it? You know, I'd like to help people that are survivors of Alzheimer's. So I'd like to relate that experience, you know, that I survived, mm-hmm. and then And they said, and I've got these interesting relatives back there. How do I work these two together? And also, Ashley, I have a real, when you go through something like that, like with Grace, what is the difference between love and obligation and devotion? You know, people throw this word on the phone, love you, you know, but you know what?
Sure.
They don't even use the word I, you know, just throw the word around. It's meaningless. But it's meaningless, but it has so much meaning. There's a just contradiction there.
Yeah.
So I decided I was going to write this thing in a way that it showed what it was like to come to survive, and interweave it with my ancestry. Because I felt there were some interesting things back there that I'd like them to live again. I think I almost felt an obligation.
Right.
To show who some of these people were, and it gave me an excuse to travel some too. I went to Scotland and went to Belfast, Ireland, to track them down a little bit.
And as you were discovering things about your ancestry and some of these people, did you find anything that really struck a particular chord with you, where you could relate to that personally, or was it always a bit of a distant thing for you?
Mother, little bit. Some people I didn't relate to at all.
Sure.
Others very much so. I came away with it with a pride associated with it, you know, because that was what I was trying to find out about myself, and I found some very capable people back there. The Klan started in the mid-15th century, part of the McIntosh, and in the Valley Tome, Clenchie. By the way, I visited the McThomas, or originally the Thomas, meeting place. There's this huge granite stone that had a plaque on it, and it was really, and it gives you a feeling of belonging or part of something, especially when you go back 500 years.
And that's kind of a running theme that came through the book. I mean, there is that theme of what does it all mean? How did I get here? But also there's that other theme that I took from it, which was of legacy, you know, and what legacy do we leave from, you know, our time here, to the people that come after us, if any, what impact is there? And obviously you're talking about how you felt that from, you know, that plaque from the mid 15th century and clearly there is something.
I think part of our reason to be is a legacy, right? Maybe that's the only reason to be, sure. You know, is to create a legacy for those who come after us, improve things. I don't think you start thinking that way till you get older, but the fact is that your early life, if you can look back at it and say, I didn't hurt anybody, I may have actually helped some people. I mean, I was pretty much, my parents were grandparent age when I was born. Unexpected child, the youngest of four. I have the characteristics of an only child.
Right.
And but I was pretty much left being my own. But I had this from my father talking about it. It's about one of the things he really talked a significant amount about was the Scottishness. So that was always embedded in my mind. So when I found out he was born in Donville, Ontario, his father, Norman, my grandfather, he was born in Donville, Ontario.
It starts to sound less Scottish all of a sudden.
Yeah. His father, Jacob, was a minister, a traveling minister, and he was born in St. Catharines, Ontario. His father, John, which had been my fourth grandfather, I lose track sometimes, he was born in Burlington, Vermont. Okay, in 1792, right? So not too much Scottishness so far, right?
Sure.
But his father, John's father, Timothy, he was actually born in Belfast. I think the family came from the Ballytobin in Scotland. But I believe during the Cromwellian era, when Cromwell just thought that Irish were only good for potatoes and babies, and started populating Ireland with Scottish people. I think that some of my relatives, one in particular, John Gordon McComb, wound up in Belfast.
Right.
And I found him when I went to Belfast. And he had two sons, Alexander and Timothy. And so they moved from Belfast to the States. It was pre-revolution. It wasn't the States, the colony.
Right.
In 1760s. So much for my father coming from Scotland. There's strong Scottish roots, but
indirectly, you know, sort of.
He did not know any of this, actually.
Right.
You know,
right.
He didn't know. It must have been passed down to him from his father.
That's the thing. That's so fascinating how that just gets passed down the line. Anyway, though, is the idea of never forget where we actually came from as a clan, and that's just being propagated, obviously, throughout the generations.
Well, I lost you there. Can you see me?
I can't see you, but it might just be the video.
Yeah, hang on a minute. I think it's, I guess I, if somebody tries to call in, it blocks us. I don't want to hang up.
I'm not sure. You might have lost the video, but it's not the end of the world. We can keep, oh, there you go.
There it is. There it is. Great.
We're back. We're back.
No, it's much, much better for me to see you.
Sure.
It's easier for me to talk. Yeah, I think it is for everyone.
Absolutely.
So when John Gordon came to the States pre-revolutionary America, he didn't stay too long. He went on through to the West and got into the fur trade.
Right.
And his sons Alexander and Timothy went with him. Alexander stayed there, and John Gordon sort of gets lost in the midst of time. I just don't know what happened to him. But Timothy, the brother Timothy, comes back and he settles, becomes a farmer more or less in Vermont, where he proceeds to have a child, John, and another Samuel, and ultimately 9 children. Alexander stayed back. And he made a lot of money. Then when he came back east, he befriended Alexander Hamilton.
Oh, really?
And between them, they owned 25% of New York State.
Wow.
You know, but it turned out to be a land grab.
Because that's another part of the novel. There's a lot of conversation about land and land ownership. And as you go through the different chapters, that seems to be a theme.
I may have overdone that a little bit, but the fact is, it's a real thing, and it's what was going on in those days. And he wound up going to debtor's prison, and Alexander got him out, found out he wasn't a citizen of anywhere. So actually at that point he became a citizen of the United States. And then he went on to help found the New York Stock Exchange. That was in combination with Alexander Hamilton. And his son, Alexander Jr., when the War of 1812 came along, which very few people know anything about. Do you know about the War of 1812?
Okay. I'm not going to pretend I do.
Okay. Not many people do. But the Brits, was between the British who owned Canada, basically, you know, Canada was still a colony, and they decided that they were going to make another attempt at us, you know, at the States. They say we started it, and vice versa. So we started fighting across the Niagara River and down the Hudson River and so forth. Along the way, Timothy the son of the father of John, decides that he's pissed off at the United States because they did not give them, the revolutionaries, the free land that they promised.
Right.
But King George, he got it, made it clear to them if they wanted to come to Canada, there was plenty of free land up there. So Timothy moved the family to Canada, to St. Catharines, just across the border. And that's where he raised his family and took John and so forth with him. The War of 1812 came along. The British inscripted John, the son, to fight against the U.S. where he was born. Right? So it was truly a civil war.
Right.
In fact, John was involved in burning down my hometown, Buffalo.
Really?
They actually crossed over Niagara River and turned down Buffalo, New York. His first cousin, Alexander, the son of the fellow that started New York Stock Exchange, he by that time he was a brigadier general in the U.S. Army, and he was fighting the Brits in Plattsburgh and the Hudson because they were trying to attack down Hudson River to get to New York City and Washington. So he was fighting there. His first cousin was burning down Buffalo, right? It was a civil war. Sure. So people, there was so much connection between the U.S. and Canada that for a place called Fort Erie, there's an armament there, partially still in existence, they would not fight against Americans. They just laid down their arms. So when we crossed the river, King George threatened to kill them all, to draw and quarter them all. Right? He didn't. A lot of Canadians would not fight, or vice versa. So, but my John, it turns out, after burning Buffalo, he's moved to Plattsburgh area where the Brits were fighting his first cousin, Alexander. Right. So here's Alexander on one side, and his first cousin on the other side. Alexander was older, and he was a general. My grandfather, John, was at most a corporal at that point, whatever the British called him. But he was an enlisted man.
Right.
But he used to write letters back to his father in St. Catharines and describing what they were doing, where they were, and so forth. And Timothy, who turned out to be a spy, this was all written. He turned out to be a U.S. spy. So he was taking information sent to him by his son and giving them to his brother, Alexander, in the States, who was feeding it to Alexander Hamilton. So they knew the strategies or the positioning of the Brits on the Hudson Valley.
I remember reading that, those bits of the book and those chapters and going, this is a
movie. You asked me what was interesting to me, and that's what I really
like. Yeah, absolutely. No, but in the sense that like that is such an intricate interconnectedness of all of it. And that I remember in the book, the sense of betrayal and how obviously that came through and living a lie, I suppose, in many ways as well for him, right? That he'd been taught or doing one thing.
He left when John and his brother Samuel came back. They had all left. Timothy and took the rest of the nine children.
That's right. That's right.
Crossed over in Detroit.
How did you go about finding all this information out? I mean, was it just lots of research online?
Actually, I told you I saw this reference to Timothy, right? And Murray McCombs had done a lot of ancestral work through Ancestry.com and other such things.
Sure.
So that was a good starting point. But then I started reading about it. Library. Actually, at one point I went to the Mormon Library north of us here in Salt Lake. And started uncovering details. But when I went to Scotland, it's little knits and pieces, sort of knitting it together. It sort of made some sense to me. Ultimately, it was exciting enough to me that I actually started writing. And But it wasn't until I left Buffalo, Western New York. I have so many great memories there, and actually all over Europe too, because I've spent a lot of time in Europe. My wife and I. The places now that exist that I can't go back to because of the memories. What I thought were going to be positive memories, that we could sit in the old folks' home and look at our pictures and things. I can't look at anything like that. When I fly into Buffalo, it was necessary sometimes. I get sick to my stomach. So I just had to leave. I traveled. I had some notoriety because of what I had done, and it worked with governments. To many countries, England as well, to develop the accent concentrator for their specific needs. They're not much different. I found in Asia there was quite a difference because of the way they live, and especially in Tokyo, they live in these small places. Sound is extremely important to them. Mm-hmm. Portability is very important to them. So I had made a lot of contacts in Southeast Asia, including Tokyo, Japan, and they wanted me to come. They wanted to give me things, thank me for such this and that. And so my friend, one particular, convinced me I should just take off. And I wound up flying to San Francisco. I'd never been to Hawaii, so I stopped in Hawaii, Maui. Flew on to Tokyo, and they treated me very well. I started out with these very negative feelings about dealing with the Japanese, because they ask the same questions over and over and over again, expecting you're going to get a different. I mean, it's like how to treat Americans 101. So I'm anyway, it can be a little aggravating because they came to me. I wouldn't go to them, so they came to me in Buffalo.
Right.
So I sort of kicked them out, and then they came back, and the government came back, and it was successful collaboration. And so they always asked me to, invited me to come. But so I took advantage of that, and along with Thailand and Singapore, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, Burma. And it was all, the Japanese took care of a great deal of it, because when I went to Tokyo, there was a particular guide, a lady named Coco. And she learned that I didn't eat much. I'm very, very European. My way, I eat Northeast US European. So she found out what I would eat, and when I went on after about 3 weeks of just falling in love with Japan and the people, went on to Bangkok, and they said, take Coco with you. So she didn't speak those languages, but she made the connection with other tour guides and so forth, and she knew about my culinary habits. So that was a big help. So she went on with me through all those countries, Singapore, Bali, and Melbourne. I found Melbourne a shock to me, because I'd been for months in amongst all these Asians, right?
Sure.
Taking care of me hand and foot and so forth. Suddenly, I arrived in Melbourne and back in the States.
It's more Westernized.
In my face, type of thing. I got spoiled by the kindness, the treatment that I got throughout that part of the world. Then I went on to Christchurch. There's a couple of years ago, and it was still leveled from the earthquakes down there. Mm. Politicians got involved, and they haven't decided what to do yet. And I flew up from the South Island to Auckland, and a friend of mine, this flight surgeon for New Zealand. The interesting part of that is Air New Zealand has the longest average flight of any airline in the world. So they needed oxygen. And so they were one of the reasons I got into working with the FAA to develop a concentrator for use on board. And so, but Sandy had a fellow Scot. You know, I call myself Scottish.
That legacy's been
much as anybody else. Yeah. Yeah. He lived in Wellington, you know, at the southern tip of the North Island. He came up to me in Auckland, and we had a grand old time. This was all distraction for me.
Sure.
And he told me Hobbiton was where they filmed Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, the only way we're going to get down there is by helicopter. Are you willing to do that? You know, actually, the stuff used to be highly claustrophobic.
Right.
When I went through this, everything became trivial. Neuroses like that become trivial. It all goes aside. Who cares? You know, everything else, it just doesn't mean anything.
Perspectives change radically, don't they?
Oh, yeah. So many things that we worry about are just meaningless. You know, we garbage our mind up with it. So we got on a helicopter with a pilot. He didn't fly. We flew down to Hobbiton, and I loved it. I told him, you know, if I were younger, I would really like to be able to fly one of these things. So he said, how many weeks do you have? And I said, I can be here as long as you want, you know. He said, well, 3 weeks, I'll have you doing it. So the pilot, that is,
yeah.
Sandy coordinated it. But within three, I was going up 1,000 feet and down 1,000 feet.
Oh, wow. You know?
I loved, if I were younger, I would have, just a wonderful way to get around. Just a wonderful way to get around. And I went on from Auckland to Hawaii, to the Big Island. And my friends were getting a little antsy about me. And so they met me in the Big Island, Hawaii, and tried to convince me to go back. It was for Easter. They weren't successful. But while I was there, my friend, Tony, he really wanted to go to Oahu. He wanted to see the memorial there. So I said, well, we can take a helicopter. It's a 2.5-hour helicopter ride. And he'd never been in a helicopter. So I arranged for it, the capacity of seven. There were four of us on there, and took off over the ocean. And Tony got sick. Oh, God. It was whaling time, and then the pilot would swoop down, you know, close to the water to see the whales. I didn't care. I thought it was great fun. And if you've ever been in a helicopter on Maui or in there, my God, it's beautiful. It's the only way to see it. It's beautiful. Tony, ginger helps, I guess. So this guy had ginger to chew on. So Tony's, but he dreaded coming back because we went to Oahu. He was better coming back, but he always reminds me about that, suckering him into that long ride. But I loved it, and it was total reversal for me as far as the claustrophobia is concerned. Mm. I went to a period I couldn't even get on an airplane for quite a long time. Yeah. But you know, again, that's all trivial now. And from a guy my age to a guy your age, try to sort out the trivial, okay? There's certain things that don't mean crap.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Don't worry about it. You know, there's something you have no control over them, and in the end, they don't mean anything. When you look back at them, if you look at it you know, you can put your size in retrospective and not say, "Gosh, what a waste of time that was." You know, the earlier you can do that in life, I think you get more out of life in general.
I can imagine that. And I think sometimes, yeah, you know, you're lucky enough to learn it for yourself. Other times it takes a good kick in the teeth and something happens and we learn the hard way. I don't know which is good or bad, but
I don't think there's any, you know, I believe in good and evil. You know, I think there is evil in the world. Okay.
Yeah.
But as far as things, doing something good or doing something bad relative to if you're going to bungee jump, you know, do it. You know?
Sure. Sure.
I'll do anything at this time, at this point. I find it, and it saddens me somewhat in that I didn't realize that younger, know that I could have been enjoying those things
sure.
younger. Instead, I'd restrict myself doing it again. I wouldn't even try. And that's another story, because I had an older brother that was
similar to in the book.
That did some things that resulted in my neuroses.
Well, that's the other thing, right? A lot of things we get predisposed to when we're very young, and they get imprinted in our psyche in a level that we're not even aware of, and we just operate on these wavelengths and patterns that we deem our own, that aren't necessarily things that we have even chosen for ourselves. And it takes
our objectivity.
Sure.
Yeah, we lose our objectivity. We get so involved with things we do not. I pride myself on being pragmatic, you know, but there's some I think back about very much so technologically when it comes to laws of thermodynamics, but on an emotional level, I certainly made the right choice, or we did with Grace, myself. But there are other decisions I made along the line where, boy, was I naive, why didn't I know better?
I'd like to think, though, that that's a common thread that pretty much every human will have in their life at some point. It's just many of us are better at pretending that that's not the case.
Yeah.
I don't think everybody or anybody has it figured out. That's my naive opinion, maybe. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. The more people that I opened up to about this subject, and hadn't been many, I come to realize there's a commonality of thought. We all have these issues. There's a different degrees,
sure.
coming from different directions, from different people, but there's a commonality associated with it. But the sooner you can come to terms with what's important and what isn't important, I think you can lead a happier life, and those around you. So that you can. I was lucky enough in my sojourn. One of the reasons I had gone from Hawaii. I wasn't going back with them. So, but I had friends in Vancouver, BC.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew from Hawaii to San Francisco and then up to meet with him, an old hockey friend. And I stayed with him for a while. Then I had somebody drive me down the coast to a lady named Heidi Meyer, who I do sculptures, and she did my bronze work. And she's in Vancouver, Washington, about 5-hour drive. I had a really great conversation with a Native Canadian. I'm so used to saying Native Americans,
yeah.
but just a Native Canadian. We had a great conversation. That 5 hours went like that, and I learned a lot, really. That's one of the highlights of my trip, a drive to Vancouver, from Vancouver to Vancouver. So I stayed with Heidi and her husband for a bit. And I was supposed to go to San Jose. I have another friend down there that he's a subject calling himself. He and his wife, wonderful people. But Sherry, the wife, wasn't going to be there for a few days. So Heidi had a friend that directed me in the direction of Las Vegas, Silver City, outside. They had a friend. I stayed with him for a while. And he brought me into the city, Vegas. And so I stayed in the Bellagio for a while. Man, I hated it.
Oh, really?
It was, just swarming with people.
Yeah.
And I don't. It isn't now, but it was. Sure. I don't sleep that well, and I like to go out walking at night, but you just don't do that there.
Not in Vegas.
There's so many people. I like the shows and everything. But so I left there and went back to San Jose and stayed with David and Sherry. And then finally, they convinced me to meet them in San Antonio. And I hadn't been there, so I went to San Antonio, and then I flew back to Buffalo. But I couldn't take it very long. I had other connections here in Vegas relative to a being an expert witness on some lawsuit and ASME, American Society of Mechanical Engineers. So there was some reason to come back. Mm. And they convinced me that there was a better place to stay in the Bellagio, and that was Encore, which was private, more like a private club type thing. Wynn owned it. Now that he's in disgrace, no longer involved with it. But that made life easier. But then my lawyers, since I was there so much, convinced me I should get a place outside the city. Because most people, maybe yourself included, when you think of Nevada, it's only Las Vegas. But there are actually a lot of cities here. Sure. There's a place called Henderson, which is just south and east of Vegas. And it's a real community. It's for real. So that's why I am right now. I live here. And I was lucky enough to meet, after many years, I met a lady that I actually had some interest in, because I was had zero interest for a long time. So I met a very, very nice lady, and she likes to travel. And we're yin and yang. There'll never be, you know, there's a first love. There can be additional loves, as there is, but I still go into states of depression sometimes when I think too much about what Grace and I had and what she meant to me. And those last years of, you know, it's not the right word, but we use the word anthropomorphic for putting ourselves into the mind of creatures. Well, whatever the proper word for that is, I would imagine myself being in her situation of being trapped.
Yeah.
Because for the period of time she knew it, yeah, just that was, you know, panicked me. I am, by the way, I am, the proceeds of the book are going to the Alzheimer's Association.
I saw, yeah, which is amazing.
Yeah. Well, not, it's a, they're really not making any headway at all. But I know when she was ill, which I still had her, I looked into everything. And I felt sure that I you know, Big Shot, was going
to
figure it out. And I thought, I dreaded that somebody, there was something out there that somebody knew but that could help. And a lot of charlatans out there, a lot of lying going on about, for money, just to sell some drug or treatment.
Sure.
I said maybe. It was all about maybes and hope, and I see some little sign. Oh, it's a good thing. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like this and this and this, but it's constantly going down. And that's the hardest part to talk about. But in the end, so the book consists of me surviving, looking back at my ancestors and me trying to figure out where I came from.
And then finding a new, I don't want to say a new life, but finding that sort of balance again where you can have a little bit more peace than what you perhaps had during those turbulent times, if that's the better
way. That's where the word love came in, because I was struggling with that. You know, I couldn't feel joy. I felt guilty. Sure. And what am I still, why am I still alive? You know, how do I deserve to feel joy? You know, so that even today, if I start really getting happy about something, I start pulling myself back. I'm getting better, but I think people that have gone through this experience would understand what I'm saying. So I wanted to get that point across, especially in the first chapter, that you can survive, but you have to focus on something else. You know, in my case, it was my ancestry. I needed a reason to get up in the morning. And that's where the name of the book came from obviously.
Yeah.
And we all need a reason to be. And if you ask yourself that, I like to learn something new every day. What am I going to learn today? And really learn it, and, you know, memorize it. Only way I can remember things is to connect them with something. That's the way we work, obviously, how we function. So I try to live up to that. my partner, Suki, she's a mature woman who loves to ballroom dance. And when I first met her through business, I realized we'd go out to the dinner or whatever, and she'd like to dance. I could dance, but not like her. You know, she got on a dance floor and it's like everybody stood back, just a natural dance, but never had lessons. So I had gone to Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, for some work I was consulting on up there. And I was staying, Mayo Clinic's in Rochester, about 90 minutes south of Minnesota, Minneapolis. So I had flown up there and was in Minneapolis, and it turns out there was a world dance competition there. So I called Suki. We weren't really a couple at all, but I just called her. I said, you really love to dance. Have you ever really seen a competition? She said, no. Why don't you come up here? I got your room. So we went to this competition, and she just, you know, really excited. It is exciting once you get to know something about it in particular. So she, we met a Russian couple. Many Russians are into that. We met a Russian couple through another person, and they invited us to come to another competition. We not compete, but just as a guest in Irvine, California. So we went there. And while I was there, her name is Natalie and Andre Pomeroto. While we were there, it dawned on me, what am I doing? You know, Suki should have dance lessons. So I asked Natalie about that. You know, in Vegas, it happened to be one particular, really one of the top-notch teachers here in town, in Vegas. He lives in Summerlin, actually, up north. But we made contact with him, and she started taking lessons. And I remember we set up the first lesson, and I was really anxious to see what he would think. You know, because I had seen her dance, but who am I? You know? But he asked her, "What's your favorite dance?" She said, "Oh, just about anything. Cha-cha is okay." So they started to dance. And she puts it on out there, right? And Leon's name is Leon Hernandez. He stops. And he said, wait, he says, "You've never had lessons?" "No." Said, "I'm used to Mack trucks coming in here, and now I've got a Ferrari, you know." And from there, it took off, because now she's competing.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah, she does really well. She's a senior, but she competes against all levels. And she's a small, very athletic woman, very good shape, keeps herself that way. But so that's fun. Now we can't, there aren't any comps anywhere.
Sure.
But we get on, there's something called JSX, which is a private jet. It's semi-private, but it takes you all up and down the West Coast, and a lot of shows out here.
Right.
So we just hop on that thing. But now we just stay away from airplanes.
Yeah, for
so
now.
That's a part of my life to learn. I'm learning to be a judge. I think I'm going to be a judge.
Okay.
Everything I get involved in, somehow I professionalize it. But I really enjoy watching it and learning what the judges are looking for. So it's also she and I have that to talk about, and I can do my little judging routine here in the living room, which is right behind me. By the way, it's 111 here right now.
I can imagine it's.
I think I may have told you.
You did at the top. Yeah. It's toasty. Yeah. Did all of this really sort of, you spoke about it before, did the whole moment really stem from that point?
I think it all stemmed from the White House. Yeah.
Right.
That was where I just, that to me, that was profound. After I talked to the writer the night before, he asked questions that I had never asked myself. And he opened it up, you know, so
sure.
Maybe I really should be making sure that I remember all this stuff. I haven't lost my memory. So.
Sure.
But maybe I will. So I better get work to make sure that I document the experience. So beyond this, I started a memoir, which is easier actually, because I'm just
writing about your life. Sure.
Yeah. And then in the act, you have to mine your brain. You know, get this little gray cells moving around up there.
Sure.
Stuff comes forward that oh my goodness, I forgot all about that. I think that's really therapeutic part about writing. You have to think deeply, you have to personalize it, and you bring thoughts to your cerebellum that you didn't know existed anymore.
It's also that not just bringing them there, but then actually physically putting that on the paper. I don't know about you, but I feel that when you do that, it makes it even more profound because you physicalized it in some capacity.
Yeah.
And that just materialization of it actually, in a weird way, lets you process what was a thought inside that little bit of gray matter to take more resonance on.
Yeah. You're a fan of Agatha Christie with Poirot? You know who Poirot is?
I do. I'm not going to say that I've read their stuff.
No, but he always talks about the little gray cells.
Right.
He called it the little gray cells. They get him working up there.
Sure. So, did you ever in your wildest dreams expect that you would have at any stage in your life or career been invited to the White House for that
honor? It was a total surprise to me, because once I sold the W.R. Grace, I was pretty much a technologist. That was one of the most prolific times of my life, patent-wise, because I didn't have to think much about the business end of it. Cause up to that, the business I had, I owned.
Sure.
And we had to do everything, but then I could concentrate on. But actually, I know best. And as far as somebody else's, I can't see you, but I'll just keep talking.
Okay.
I never really thought about it. I had gotten awards for various things. I was given the Edison Award by American Society of Mechanical Engineers, which was, I was surprised by that. And I've been given various awards. Wounded Warriors, where they supply oxygen so they can get the war. There's a lot of these veterans aren't able to fly without oxygen. Mm-hmm. So I gave them a lot of equipment. But they give me these little things along the way. The Edison Award was the biggest one.
Sure.
And the patent lawyers gave me some things. But I was really taken aback by it was actually in Switzerland, home in Switzerland. And I was called. I was on the throne, so to speak, and I had my BlackBerry. it was the Secretary of Commerce calling, telling me that I had been awarded this National Medal of Technology and Innovation. And that's the first I heard about it. So, and for a few days it was unreal, because I would never have expected such a thing. And I read about it. You know, Stephen Jobs has been given that. There's a lot of long list of people. I don't fit in that category even a little bit. Nor do I with Edison, but I was just taken aback by that. So they asked me if I would be available to talk to them the following week. And I told her, you know, there's a 6-hour difference here. I'm in Switzerland. But we arranged some time. It was like 5:00 in the afternoon, my time. And we had a dinner scheduled with some Swiss friends. And we had some friends of ours as well. So there were 4 of us together. Grace knew, but nobody else knew. So I told them to call me at 5:00. I said, Grace, we'll go to see Heinz and Erna we'll get there early and get all the kisses over with, you know that routine, right?
That old European routine. Yeah.
Well, some three times. Yes. Okay. So we get all that over with and we'll sit down, and then eventually the phone will ring. So 5 o'clock, the phone rang, and they have a hallway to their entrance, and I walked down the hall, and Grace told me later that I was really acting foolish. I was leaning up against the wall and doing all this stuff, because all of a sudden they put Obama on, and I'm talking to him. Here I am in the middle of the Alps. There's I don't know if you know Switzerland at all.
I've not been, but.
Okay. There's a town called, it's right sort of central, German speaking, right on the edge of German French speaking, Neustadt. So I don't really, I know they said some nice things. I was just very nervous, excited, I get more than that. I was just, here I am in the middle of the Alps, modern technology. But it was a BlackBerry. It's nothing like what you have in front of me now. Is comparatively, is amazing. When I worked in electronics, I have a degree in electrical engineering. It was all binary. It was zeros and ones. So, people don't understand what
it's.
They call themselves programmers, but I got off the phone and I went. Heinz and Erna, they don't speak English. And I said, that's for Obama. That was Obama.
Yeah.
And I said, nay. He starts laughing. I said, really? That's for Obama. Obama, president. Yeah, president Obama. Arum, I mean, why? why?
Here we are. What have you done?
Yeah. Because they knew nothing about me. Sure. Like we had lived in that area for quite a long time. We were they actually accepted us as Americans. We were there so long, and Heinz and Erna were good friends, so they spoke well of us, even though we were American. But we were the unusual Americans. We spoke the language.
Sure.
But we're just Americans, and we happen to love the countryside there and the people. But it takes a while to get to know them. But in any event, it was one of the people that was with us named Rita, she's in the group hug. So all of a sudden, so we're all jumping up and down with this thing. And so it got all over town. It's a little town, 3,000 people, Schweissen. And it got to the mayor. And the mayor is also the publisher of the Berner Zeitung, the newspaper. So he asked to interview me. And they interviewed me. And I was the first non-Swiss to have a photograph in the Berner Zeitung.
Right.
They had adopted me. And this fellow, the mayor's wife, we had dinner with them. And very, very naively, but she wasn't kidding. She said at that time is when Mandela had died, and Obama went there, and she said, maybe, if you like, in German, maybe on the way back, we can land here and we can have tea. No. I met him. I know I've talked a while with him. But no. And that's a 747. That's not going to land on that little glider strip we have over there. But she meant it. They can be very myopic. But somehow I had this connection. I think she was disappointed in me. That I wasn't. She thought I was a big shot, but I wasn't big enough shot to come to Swiss.
Maybe he had other things to do.
But from that point on, people all looked at me differently.
Sure.
They all like they all suddenly they had, people before we'd say Gruzi, which is just a Gruskot Gruzi, and but now they would pass the time of day, and I used to climb a lot, and I had a white hat I wore all the time and a cane. And I was, my physician there told me later on that I was known as the man in the man in the Weisse Hut, the man in the white hat. So that's how they knew me. But after that,
Suddenly. You were the Obama connection was how they knew.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't go into my little restaurants anymore without people talking. I got sick of it.
Local celebrity.
I really got sick of it.
I saw on the actual day, there is obviously footage of you going up there and getting your medal and all the rest of it, which was, I'm sure, a very profound and maybe even a slightly odd experience to have all at the same time. Did he have any words for you throughout the rest of the day? Did he share anything with you?
Yeah, when I went out, there's something I feel very strongly about, and it's automatic weapons. And I didn't know if I was going to see him again after that stage connection. So I met him, and he said some nice words, congratulating. He said he'd read about me and congratulated me. And he had a relative that used an oxygen concentrator, which, you know, was, anyway, he said some nice things. And I leaned over to him. If you watch the video, you'll see me lean over to him. And I'm saying to him, please get rid of AK-47s. Those were my words. And he said, well, there's a strong Southern lobby against it. And I really hated that. I didn't want that response, you know, political response. I think there were so many executive directives that he gave. He could have done that too, but he didn't. I liked the guy. I mean, he's a very human guy. He's very eloquent, academician, a little out of the league of working people. He's very empathetic, but I walk both sides of the line. I know the importance of entrepreneurship, and you really have to keep people like young people like you interested, you know, and not tax you to death. Keep you going, wanting to invent, wanting to do new things, and not
stay stagnant.
But he's a very nice guy. He said later we met in the blue room for photographs, and the cameramen were screwed up somehow. So we just sat down and we talked. It was the time I'm a big hockey fan. I played hockey most of my life. I'm coming from Buffalo. It's right on the Canadian border. My relatives all played. We talked about, because there was a strike going on at the time, and he knew about it. So I was surprised. And we talked about a variety of, it's basically small talk, but I got back to the gun control. I really feel strongly about that. Who needs it? Who needs an automatic weapon? You know, maybe I'm stepping on some toes, but I don't care.
I think everyone in Europe looks at it, and other countries look at it and have the same question and can't quite really comprehend it. And I know there's deep-seated reasons for it, maybe in terms of, you know, amendments and things that people believe they're...
Well, the Constitution, the Second Amendment.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, but...
Well, some of them say we have to, you know, remember we had a revolution. If we didn't have weapons, we couldn't have beat off the British, right? They're still thinking we have to fight off our government or be prepared to fight off our government.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, enough said. I mean, I just so anti-gun that I don't see any use to it. It's too easy for somebody to pull out impersonal. To pull a trigger.
You know, you shouldn't be able to.
If you're killing someone, if you're stabbing or strangling or doing something, there's something personal, but just from a distance, you know, pull the trigger, just like us dropping bombs. You know, I really.
Well, because you can distance yourself completely emotionally in every way from the action itself. So there's no consequence to you really, or as much of a consequence, because there's that divide.
I saw a really interesting show on people bumped it. Have you propped up there? You're a little seasick. I saw a really interesting show on PBS about Second World War.
Right.
And they were at the point where we had crossed over to Normandy, and we were all together. We were pushing the Germans back. And as they went, we were basically slaughtering them. And they made comments like you couldn't walk in certain areas without walking on a body. the stench. They told about war the way it should be told about. There's nothing glamorous about it.
And, yeah.
And this one pilot, fighter pilot, it was his job to go out and strafe these convoys of Germans going back, heading back to Berlin, to Germany. And he just go in and mow down all these people. And it got to a point with him that he could not, his right hand was on the trigger. And he froze at one point. He started thinking about what he was doing, the human beings that were down there. And he could no longer pull the trigger. I lost you again, but I can.
Just, yeah.
He lost feeling in his right hand. When he flew back, it was all one-handed. He had to land with one hand. And even as time went by, it gradually got better. But his wife was talking to his wife about it, and she was saying that when he'd get up in the morning, she'd never hand him his cup of coffee or tea to his right hand, because in the morning he couldn't use his right hand. Wow. But it affected, it's all psychosomatic, but it hit him, what he was doing. And he emotionally he couldn't take it. I don't know how many people have experienced that, you know, how many more, but he was out doing his job, and what a job that is. I got dropping bombs.
Yeah,
you know, even with the atomic weapons, you know, I still feel strongly that we made a mistake of dropping those atomic weapons. And there's an awful lot about revenge going on there. They talk about you know, losing a lot of American lives, but I think they could, you know, a little more patience, maybe dropping it in the ocean a few miles out.
Sure.
Setting up a tidal wave, you know, demonstrate the power of it without just dropping the damn thing.
Well, it's again that emotional response and not having emotional control to then lead to some bad decisions.
But people, I think revenge was afoot.
Sure.
You know, we're going to get back. You know, and, it's. Anyway, that's just voicing my anti-armament opinions here.
Sure.
But you guys in Britain, you've got people that feel the same way as a lot of Americans, you know. But
I think, like you said earlier, a lot of people, for the most part, are inherently good and want to do good things.
Oh yeah,
it's the small minorities. You know,
I'm trying to connect them. Actually, I want to do my bit. I had this thought, and I want us to be able to. Without saying a word to a black person, if they see me wearing something and they're wearing the same thing, I know that they've made a pledge to do their very best not to be racist. Okay? You know, and so when you look at each other, you don't have to stop and even acknowledge each other. But again, like I said, with the cross in the old days, the cross meant something. It wasn't just an ornament. So they recognized each other. I want everybody to recognize each other for who we are. I think we're born basically good. There's a certain religion that thinks we're born in sin, but I think we're born pure myself, unless there's something wrong with us. Society screws us up. And that's what I'm trying to, in my memoir, I'm trying to address are those feelings. Again, going to an all-black school, I had a little girlfriend named Gertrude in third grade. I can still remember seeing her little black hand in my hand. Nobody made anything of it, because I was part of the group. I grew up with them from kindergarten.
Sure.
You know, we moved to Amherst, which is an all white, really white community. Most of the people I went to high school, I don't think they ever touched a black person. So when we had inner city, I played a lot of football. We had scrimmages or all-star games with the city. And they'd be afraid, you know, somehow that they're different. They bleed just the way you do, and they're just as afraid of you as you are.
Everything is labels to compartmentalize stuff in a way, and I understand why we have them, but I think they only serve a purpose to a certain superficial level, because as you say, beyond that, we all bleed, we all breathe, and we all have, you know, hopes and dreams and desires. And at the end of the day, as you kind of say, you know, with the book itself, there is a connection that we all share with one another. And it's a lot more simple than what we allow ourselves to experience it a lot of the time.
I think we should, I really, I've asked a lot of people this, you know, explain to me why we need the word race. You know, why do we need that word? It stereotypes a person immediately. As soon as you say African or Indian or Asian or whatever, they expect you're stereotyped accordingly. What do we need? We're all humans, right? There's only one race. If I need blood, do I ask where I got it from? We copulate and have children. I mean, our DNA matches perfectly. I mean, what? Why do we need the word race? I've been, that's part of what I'm writing into this little epiphany. because I ask people, you know, when I use the word race, don't you automatically stereotype? You have certain thoughts about the way a person looks and even about how they might behave because of that word race. And then they have to overcome the stereotypical definition of them according to that word. So I'm for getting rid of the word race. I just don't see any purpose in it. There's things like sickle cell anemia, which people of African extraction are more likely to get. So I can understand why, but you don't have to, maybe we just find another way to do that.
Sure.
Avoid that word. It's so, it triggers so many emotions. The other day, Michelle Obama was on making a very nice speech. And she was talking about her childhood, or even now, she said, you know, people talk about, they walk down one side of the street, a white person, that they see a black person on the same side, that they'll cross to the other side of the street. Now, I don't see that. You know, that to me was 40 years ago, you know, that I don't see that, but she brought it up and was talking about it. And if we can just leave some of it, if it's real, it's a horrible thing that people treat each other like that. But if we're walking, maybe we need a different way to identify each other other than by race, okay, or color. Right? How do we get to know each other before that? Got any ideas? I'm trying to write about it.
I think for me, as I said before, it's a much simpler case than we allow ourselves to think. But the challenge is more the wiring that everybody else has been self-disposed with, because there's so much noise in the world these days with media and social media and all these different voices that I don't think people spend enough time getting to know themselves well enough to then even be able to see other people for who they are. And until you can see yourself properly, people find it more of a challenge to then relate to others. And there's a lot, I think, around that.
We're tended to be attracted to people that are like-minded, though.
Sure.
Do you agree with that?
Sure.
Right. So if we somehow, what I'm trying to do is, how can we identify to each other that we're like-minded, morally like-minded, you know, as a
value bank in terms of value.
Yeah, you know, so I'm really finding it difficult to write about that, but I'm doing it. I'm being very pragmatic about it. And now I've got an avenue. Hang on a minute here. Now I have an avenue to do it.
And so that's the next way for you, I guess. You've got the memoir. You've got the
new
writing.
Can you see me okay?
I can see you okay.
Okay, because I'm gonna have to make a visit to the necessary.
Sure.
Get out of here. I got myself.
I'm about to wrap it up. So
are you anyway?
Okay. Yeah, we'll wrap it up. So you've got your memoir, obviously. You're writing all of this, and your social media friend's gonna help you with that. The book itself, A Reason to Be, that's out September 1st. Is that right?
Yep, September 1st, and it's printed now, but it's not released until September 1st on Amazon.
Gotcha. Available everywhere.
Yeah, there's an ebook available now.
Right.
And also, there's a, what I might direct people to is normanmccombs.com, and also Norman McCombs on YouTube.
Gotcha.
So there's a cool. There's Scott put together a really nice video promo for the book.
Okay.
I'm really proud, very professional.
Well, I will. So, I will find all of those links, and I'll make sure that people can see those and find out where to buy the book. And look, Norm, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for chatting with me and for taking the time to do that. It's been really, really great, really insightful. I appreciate it.
No, maybe we can talk again sometime.
Absolutely.
Very nice talking to you.
Likewise. Okay. Thank you. Take care of yourself.
Maybe when the memoir comes up.
There you go, for sure.
Or when I start my crusade, how's that?
Both. We'll do both.
Great.
Wonderful. Okay. Take care, Norm.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
Stay well.